This is St. Louis on the Air from St. Louis Public Radio. I'm Elaine Cha. Big government. The phrase conjures the image of something oversized, bursting at the seams. And when you hear a politician talk about it, you're almost certain to hear how they want to make it smaller, more efficient, less wasteful, and, importantly, more loyal. And we're hearing about that now as the incoming Trump administration and billionaire Elon Musk tout efforts to create a Department of Government Efficiency, DOGE, or DOGE. But this isn't new. Presidents going back to the founding fathers made similar promises. They also ran into similar challenges. The fact is, part of the reason big government is big is that it contains so many people. And to understand how government got the way it is and why incoming presidents would talk about changing it, we have to get to know those people. That's part of the mission of a new digital archive that chronicles the service and stories of more than 37,000 federal employees, each who worked during our country's very first decades. It's a project that's taken years, and it holds lessons for how America's government got to be the way it is and how it might change in the future. The project's creator, Peter Castor, is a professor of history and American culture studies at Washington University, and he joins me now. Peter, welcome back to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
So this project of yours, again, 20 years ago, is called Creating a Federal Government, and it really focuses on the events and people of America's first governments. And we're talking about George Washington, John Adams, Thomas Jefferson. So in two decades, if we go back, what is the thing that inspired you to begin this endeavor?
So the inspiration for this was that long ago, long before that, I actually was a federal employee. My first job after college was working in the U.S. Department of Justice. Mm-hmm. It was a really rewarding job, but what struck me is I would read a lot of coverage in the newspaper, and I would see politicians talk about what the federal government was doing, and it seemed to have no connection to the reality of what we were doing within those within that agency and what we did well and what we didn't. And then later, as a historian who studied the founding era, I would read a lot of other historians, and they would quote from the Federalist Papers, or they would find a letter here or there from the founding fathers talking about what government should do. And I thought there's got to be a better way to get at this story, mm-hmm. to understand what it was like to work in the federal government, what it was like to run it, and what it was like to be a low-level employee.
Mm-hmm. So given that time period, we're talking between 1789 and 1829, when you say federal government, I mean, what does that mean?
So that's a terrific question. It's actually the question everyone was asking. So in 1789, the Constitution went into effect after the first federal elections. And people often talk now about how some people want to reduce government, but this was an era when the people you mentioned, George Washington, Thomas Jefferson, Alexander Hamilton of the musical, mm-hmm. they wanted to build government. They wanted to make it bigger. And to them, the federal government was something that included what we all learn about in school, the legislature, the judiciary, and the executive. Mm-hmm. And one of their first decisions was that the federal agencies were under the authority of the executive. And the agencies at that time were, in the order of their creation, the State Department, the Treasury Department, the War Department, and the Postal Service, which seems the least sort of romantic of the four, but often had some of the most employees, and it stretched across the country.
Mm-hmm. And in that era, we're talking about 30,000 federal employees?
Yeah, so I've located close to 38,000 individuals, men and women, who were federal employees between 1789 and 1829. Mm-hmm. The number in any one year varied. When it reached its steady state in the 18-teens, there were about 30,000 people. The people who aren't in this, who would increase the number, are enlisted personnel in the Army and later the Navy. It's mm-hmm. much more difficult to find their names and careers, but I've got civil officials, commissioned officers, and as I said, it's men and women who were federal employees during this time.
Mm-hmm. I'd like to invite you to this conversation. Do you have a question or comment about how the Founding Fathers viewed the federal government as we're talking about how it got built? Mm-hmm. Do you think the president has the power to hire and fire whomever they want? Give us a call at 314-382-8255. That's 382-TALK. Or you can send us an email at talk@stlpr.org. So, Peter, you are studying the federal workforce. That is a big part of this project. How would one get a government job in the late 1700s or early 1800s to start with?
Right. That's a great question. Let's begin with the fact there's no HR. There's no human resources department. And people try to get jobs in all kinds of ways. The thing that was most striking to me is that when George Washington arrived in New York in 1789 to begin as president, and the federal government was located in New York for almost 2 years, he was besieged with people who just wrote to him personally. And he'd never met these people. And he received, just during the time it was in New York, he got over 300 letters personally.
Right.
People writing to him, some of them people who had held office previously who wanted to keep it, some people who wanted a job in the first place. Some of them were people who were known to him personally. Examples I can think of is there were a lot of other members of the Virginia gentry who would write to him and say, you know, I'd like to be Secretary of State or Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. But one of the other examples that I always like is a revenue official in Boston whose office was about to become, to go from state authority to federal jurisdiction. Mm-hmm. And he writes this letter saying, I served in the Revolution. I've been serving the state. I've got a big family. Please don't fire me. And Washington ends up keeping him. He's a guy named Thomas Melville.
Okay.
And he serves for 30 years. He stays there from 1789 till, actually closer to four, he stays until 1829. He's finally fired by Andrew Jackson because by then he's about 80 years old.
Okay. Wow. For that time?
Exactly.
Yeah.
And the final part of it is he probably told his grandson, Herman Melville, that this was a steady gig. And Herman Melville's first job was in the Customs House in New York. And he probably learned that from his grandfather.
Right, right. That's incredible. So it really then was about who you knew, maybe who you were related to, and having some access.
Right. So that mattered. What strikes me, though, are the number of people who secured employment during this time who don't seem to have any connection. They, most importantly, they make this case that they're committed to the principles of the American Revolution, the principles of the Constitution. Their appeal to party connection, well, at first there are no political parties. They can't appeal to that. And later, even later, those appeals are kind of muted. Mm-hmm. When they write asking for jobs, they sort of frame it around the notion of their own competence to do the job. And there are only so many people you can know as the president.
Right.
So you have to rely on the wording that people use. You have to rely on recommendations from other people. Mm-hmm. A lot of it is quite similar to how people apply for jobs now. You write letters of application and recommendation, but the terms they used were very different. And it was much more disorganized and haphazard.
So what was it like then to go through these people's records? I mean, there were no computers at that time. I mean, much of it must have been handwritten.
Oh, it's all handwritten.
Yeah.
And years ago, I was working in not just the letters people were sending, but the letters from the president. So years ago, I was working in the National Archives, and I saw a reference to nominations, Jefferson administration. And they brought out, it was an ammo box. It was an old ammo box, because that's where they had this stuff stored. And these were the letters from Thomas Jefferson to the Senate nominating people to office, and they're all written in his hand. So what I want to emphasize is that at first glance, this government looks lean and mean and very efficient. I think it's tremendously inefficient in some ways. You have the president of the United States, supposed to be making big decisions, brand new government, who seems to be spending about half his day writing up lists, not just of here's who I nominate for Secretary of State, but here's who I nominate to be a second lieutenant in the United States Army.
Right.
So it's they were really struggling to find their way.
Mm-hmm. Now, I understand that's something that you've not been able to review yet, are about 18,000 letters of recommendation.
Yeah.
What is it, Peter, that interests you about those letters?
Right.
And, you know, are there specific examples from letters that you have seen that sort of point to, you know, what you hope to learn?
Right. So the thing that interests me most about this project is that it gives us both ends of the founding era, which, again, we learn about in school, but in the most abstract sense. And I wanted to get at, what is it really like to govern? How did the founders govern? And so we get to understand both the way these familiar, high-ranking office holders made decisions, but also what it was like for really the folks who are at the front lines of federal governance, these low-level officials. And as you said, there are about 18,000 letters of application and recommendation. I have reviewed all of them from the Washington administration. They really give you a glimpse of what the revolution and the Constitution meant to average Americans, the people applying for jobs. And they had a pretty consistent sense of what it meant. The most important things to them, first of all, was that it meant government without monarchy. That was the big break, that it was Republican government in that sense. But it was also a government that was supposed to be bigger than the office holders. The notion was their loyalty was to the Constitution, not to the president. And they would write that to the president. My loyalty is to the Constitution. They didn't say not to you, but implied in that is that they would not be agents of tyranny, that they would serve whoever was in office effectively. And we take that for granted now, that a public employee serves the office, not the person in charge, that they serve the public, not the party. But this is at a time when that's a very new idea. And you can just see thousands of people who they somehow just understood it. It's what they had learned and internalized in the 20 years, starting, you know, in the decades since the U.S. had declared independence in 1776. Mm-hmm. And I got to admit, I came out of it. It was a very heartening experience to read that, their sense of this, and what the future of the nation should be.
Mm-hmm. That's a great place for us to take a very quick break. This is St. Louis on the Air on St. Louis Public Radio.
The Gateway brings you the day's news each weekday from around the St. Louis region and the state capitals in Jefferson City.
Our schools are accredited. We don't need this bill.
And Springfield.
How many more years must pass before lawmakers see time is of the essence?
I'm Abby Larico. Join me each weekday for The Gateway on the STLPR app or wherever you get podcasts.
Welcome back. We're talking today with Peter Castor, a history professor at Washington University, and we're discussing his research project, a 20-year-long effort that's come together in a new public digital archive that looks back at the earliest years of America's federal government, an archive that encompasses the records of more than 37,000 federal employees, and that is something that you can find at cfg1789.org. WUSTL.edu, and we'll be sharing that URL again later in our conversation. Before the break, we're talking about, you know, the number of employees, the letters that people wrote in order to work in the federal government, and it revealed a lot, Peter, you were saying, about how they understood what their job should be, what their relationship could be as an employee of the federal government. And something I think to think about has to do with the size of government, right? Talk a little bit about that.
Of course. So let's begin with the fact that the federal government was, of course, smaller than it is now. There are about 3 million federal employees now. Numbers vary. When this government reaches its steady state in the 18-teens, it was probably about 30,000 employees at any one time, civil and military. And what I want to emphasize during this time is often we'll hear about how the founders were, you know, they always wanted small government. And there certainly were times when they would say that, especially when a new administration came into office. Mm-hmm. But what's striking to me is that each administration I look at came in with that principle, and then all of them end up expanding government. And it's not that they are, it's not that they were in some way seduced by growing the government, but rather each administration faced some domestic or foreign crisis, and they said, we need resources for this. Mm-hmm. It's also at a time when the U.S. was expanding the territory it claimed. The federal government had to govern that. And each administration realized that in some way. And so what you end up with, as I often put it, is a government that was certainly larger and more ambitious than a lot of conservative government critics now would claim, but also one that was smaller and didn't do as much as many liberals now might wish that it did. It's mm-hmm. sort of, it doesn't fit anyone's preconceived notion.
Right. So you'd mentioned, Peter, new presidents coming in. And I want to make sure that we get to Thomas Jefferson.
Absolutely.
America's third president. He went about business aligning, you know, personnel with personal vision of government and of governing in a very particular way. And it really changed the way American presidents related to the government. So to put it bluntly, Jefferson did a lot of firing.
He totally did a lot of firing. Yeah, it's a great question. So let's begin with the fact that separate from the personality of Thomas Jefferson, he was the first president from one party to replace another party. He succeeded John Adams, who was from the Federalist Party. Jefferson was from the Republican Party. It's not the Republican Party we have now. That's a different one. Mm-hmm. But he came into office and his first question was, do I need to keep all of Adams's appointees, all of his employees? And he asked his Secretary of the Treasury, a guy named Albert Gallatin, who said, fire them all. Mm-hmm. One of the first things he did was he called in his private secretary, Meriwether Lewis of Lewis and Clark Expedition fame, okay. and said, get me a list of every officer in the Army and let me know what party they're in. Mm-hmm. Obviously thinking he was going to fire all the Federalists. And in 1802, Jefferson did indeed fire a bunch of federal employees who he suspected were Federalists. Most of them were revenue officials. And he did this both to try to get rid of Federalists and also because he believed, you know, he said, I want to reduce the number of employees. And it was his first step at the time, he thought, to getting rid of all the Federalists. And then eventually he stops because he realized that kind of purge was going to disrupt government operations. It's very difficult to tell people's political allegiances. Mm-hmm. There were some people of high competence who he decided to keep. And I think almost most importantly, within a year, really in the run-up to the Louisiana Purchase, he realized he did not need a smaller government. He actually needed a bigger government. Mm-hmm. And so he quickly starts employing people, most of them Republicans, you know, members of his party. But this notion that you could very easily just get rid of everyone you disagreed with, he's the first president to learn that ain't going to work the way you think it will.
Mm-hmm. So there was what was anticipated and then what actually
Absolutely.
Happened.
Absolutely, yeah.
We have Ed who is calling from South County with a question. Ed, welcome to St. Louis on the Air.
Question. I have an observation. Politics was as dirty then as it is today, and there was no vetting. No vetting, apparently, of any kind. And so it's the roll of the dice whether you would get good people in or not. Flipping that to today, my disappointment is that all of these appointments to these boards and commissions seem to me they are political because they don't report what's going on to their bosses, to their executives. They don't alert them to things that should not be happening, that are happening, and they don't bring to them opportunities. It just seems like a neutral process today.
Mm-hmm. Ed, thank you.
Yeah. So Ed, those are actually some great points, and they get to the fundamental challenges that governments always face, which is how to establish the credentials of the people who've applied for office, how to have agencies that do their jobs that aren't consumed by politics. In the period I study, what makes it all the more challenging is they don't have anything we can use now. There's no SAT. There's no GPA. There are none of these forms of academic credentialing that are used now to get into college and then college grades that are used to determine who you might want to hire or high school grades. So it has to work very differently. It was far more limited. There was some vetting, and one of the amazing records we have is from 1798, when George Washington came out of retirement to take command of the army. Mm-hmm. Looked like the U.S. was going to go to war with France. And we have his notes for selecting officers, and he did try to vet them. He said, what is this person's education level? What is his experience? What is his handwriting like? Because he thought, he thought handwriting would be an indication of the person's education and sophistication. Mm-hmm. But this became an obsession of government a century later, in the 1880s and 90s, when a lot of people calling for reform in government said a lot of what Ed said, which is public employees seem to be corrupt and incompetent, and that we needed what people then talked about as a reformed civil service. We need ways to evaluate who we're hiring, evaluate them once they're hired. We need to have them organized in bureaus. And that's where we get the word bureaucracy. Bureaucracy in the 1880s and 90s was supposed to make government more efficient. We now tend to use it to say something that's inefficient. But a lot of the ways we talk now about how we want government to work, which is that most public employees should be apolitical, highly competent, and work through a whole system of selection and promotion. You know, we hear about new forms of it, but it's been around for almost 150 years.
Yeah, we've just a couple minutes left. But how is it that the work that you are doing with this creating a federal government important in the context of what we're looking at now, particularly with all of the attention
Absolutely.
To the Trump administration? I mean, how much has changed and why is it valuable to look back to the past?
Well, I think it's tremendously important because let's begin with the fact that we're about to see the confirmation hearings of the people who the Trump and, you know, incoming President Donald Trump has nominated federal officers. We're going to hear a lot of references to the founding fathers and what they wanted. And that's often resting on very limited knowledge about them. So I think that's important. The other thing is people invoke the founding fathers to always call for increase or reduction in federal government without much connection to the fact that at that time, that's going on constantly, that the founders themselves did not seek to eradicate government. They just sought to find a good balance, and that we've had Donald Trump say he's like this big fan of recess appointments because he doesn't want the Senate meddling in who he wants to be appointed. The founding fathers believed unshakably in advice and consent. They thought it was absolutely essential that the Senate be an active partner in populating the federal government.
Mm-hmm. Advice and consent is something we should probably take up in a future conversation.
I agree.
Peter Castor is a professor of history and American culture studies at Washington University. He's also the originator of the ongoing project Creating a Federal Government. Peter, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
This episode was produced by Danny Wisentowski.
Audio engineering and podcast design by Aaron Dorr.
Our executive producer is Alex Hoyer.
St. Louis on the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio. Understanding starts here.
Do you find yourself regularly listening to episodes of St. Louis on the Air? Suggest us to a friend you think might enjoy our conversations. And leave us a review and rating on Apple Podcasts on the App Store. It's the simplest way to help people discover our show. Thank you.
St. Louis Public Radio is a member-supported service of the University of Missouri-St. Louis.